we have to answer somehow to the creatures of Earth, to those who come after us, and I think to a God who called creation good in the beginning. And that sense that we are answerable brings dignity to our position, but it also is rather sobering.
John Gatta is Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Connecticut and the University of the South, Sewanee. At that latter institution, he held for many years the distinguished William R. Keenan Chair of English, and he's a former guest of the BYU Humanities Center. He's the author of several books, including an elegant and sobering book we discussed today, The Saving Grace of America's Green Jeremiad. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. John, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
You know, so we're talking today about the book you published earlier this year, The Saving Grace of America's Green Jeremiad. And in the acknowledgement page of that book, you very generously attribute the origins of the project to your participation in a symposium that hosted by the Humanities Center back in the fall of 2019. But of course, I thought to invite you to that symposium because I was a fan of your earlier work on nature and the environment in American literary and historical contexts. So I guess my first question for you is, when did your interest in American views of nature begin taking a distinctively eco-critical turn?
Thank you, Matt. From my high school years, going back that far, I developed a great love and involvement in the writings of Henry Thoreau. And for a while, that was part of shaping my vision of things, and struggled to reconcile that with my Christian vision in some respects. But it's later, to answer your question more directly, with the rise of interest in what came to be called eco-criticism, particularly Lawrence Buell's book on the environmental imagination.
Yeah, great book, wasn't it?
That is a great book, and I enjoyed meeting Larry Buell and working with him some later. Actually, it was a graduate student at the University of Connecticut who said to me, "You seem to be interested in nature themes. How about offering a whole course on that topic for which I will serve as grad assistant, and we'll talk about those things in extended phrases?" That was the beginning of my involvement. I owe a great deal to that particular graduate student.
Fantastic. Yeah, students are a wonderful source of inspiration in my experience. Right? Yeah, so good for your graduate student. We're all blessed by that grad student suggestion, John. Now, the book that you've written here, The Saving Grace of America's Green Jeremiad, is about a particular kind of environmental writing, a genre of lament about the present state of nature. And you call this genre America's Green Jeremiad. Can you explain what this means?
Sure. The term Jeremiad is taken after the namesake of the Hebrew prophet Jeremiah in the 17th century before the Common Era, who is indeed known as a poet, writer of lamentation. The biblical book of Lamentations, most scholars think, was not directly written by him, but there's plenty of lamentation in the prophetic book of Jeremiah. And in America, the New England Puritans often referred to this and presented forms of discourse that could be called Jeremiads. I think an informal title for what the book is all about could be called something like, you know, Where's the Grace in Prophecies of Planetary Ruin? But part of what the difference in short of what the Jeremiad is about, it contains grief, lamentation about something, and a green Jeremiad, of course, about lamentation about something in the green world that we inhabit. But it's not only lamentation. It's also involves something of a protest. Ed Abbey's discourses are full of anger as well. And above all, where a Jeremiad differs from a diatribe or a gripe, we might say, and where it also differs from apocalyptic, is that there is an element of hope It's not simply complaint.
Right.
It's also suggesting that it suggests that the essence of the Jeremiah is it's almost too late. We are headed for some kind of ruin, but there is still that possibility of grace held out. So it's that element of hope, of choice, that is important in the Jeremiah. So that is, I think, the essence of what the Jeremiah is all about. It contains grief, yes, but also often indignation,
yeah.
But indignation mixed with love. And if we think of things like stories of Jesus cleansing the temple,
right.
There is indeed indignation, but based ultimately on a love and a sense of what the temple stands for is something so worthy of love that it calls forth this concern, this even anger, that is directed toward one hopes some sort of restoration.
Okay, great. You know, the Jeremiah really then is it's a genre kind of a multivalence, right? There's a lot in it that's very nuanced, and that really strikes me as being appropriate for your work, John. From what I've read of your work, because there's a real graceful note to your work, but it's also very pointed in what you write and very incisive. You know, in this book, you address a wide swathe of writers who adopt this Green Jeremiah discourse, and mm-hmm. Some names in the book will be familiar to most of our listeners. Names like Henry David Thoreau and Wendell Berry and Al Gore, right, for his 2006 documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. Other names like Rachel Carson or Marjorie Stoneman Douglas or John Muir will be familiar to many of our listeners, some at least. Other names, though, were new to me, names like Sonora Babb or Elizabeth Colbert or H. Paul Santmeyer. And I think it would be new to many people listening to the podcast. I guess I have two sets of questions then about the book. First, how much research did you have to do to find all these people, or were you already familiar with them? That's the first question. And the second is, are all these writers conscious of taking up this biblical prophetic genre, the Jeremiah, or has the genre become so ingrained in us culturally that we inhabit it without recognizing its biblical origins?
Yes, well, I think with respect to that question about research, as you know, because you are a researcher as well, the essence of research, or the beginning of the essence of research, isn't so much coming up with answers, but coming up with questions. So I think the way for me that I approach some of this is to ask, when there are certain crises of environmental woe in America, who was there to speak about it? And I didn't always know the name. So, you know, for example, in the 1930s, I certainly heard of the Dust Bowl crisis in the Southwest. Who besides John Steinbeck might have written about that or had been a voice in it? And so I came across one of the film documentaries that seemed to me significant.
Okay. All right.
I think there's another part of your question.
Yeah, just the question. Yeah, that was great. But this, the other part of the question was, you know, are the writers that you'd address, are they conscious of this biblical genre of the Jeremiah, or is it just so culturally ingrained that it's unconscious to us? We just kind of do it naturally, so to speak.
Right. I think it's been in, so to speak, the American grain, not always with full consciousness. And sometimes people are building upon other examples, so
yeah.
That, you know, Al Gore, certainly, you know, he had Rachel Carson's picture in his office as vice president. He was well aware of her. And I think that going back to one of the progenitors of the Jeremiah form, though not necessarily the Green Jeremiah, Harry Beecher Stowe was
sure.
Very aware of the Puritan antecedents, yes. Extremely aware, and other people were aware of Stowe as an example of the Jeremiah form, whether applied to the issue of slavery, as she chose to do, or to certain environmental issues. So I think there's been a kind of piggybacking, and while the Jeremiah is certainly not unique to American literary consciousness, it's more distinctively been a part of our heritage. The Revolutionary War in case in point, where the Jeremiah was part of what you had to inveigh against as you saw as the corruptions of Europe and so forth.
Okay, all right, thank you. You know, this podcast, Faith and Imagination Podcast, is an ecumenical podcast, and it focuses broadly on aspects of religious and spiritual life. And one reason why I invited you to be a guest on it is because I'm always moved, John, by the gentle but principled strains of religious and spiritual and moral thinking in your work. So if I may, let me ask you to comment on a couple passages in the book that kind of speak to that. And they're both from the introduction here. Here's the first. I'm quoting you here. You write on page 3, what I'm calling America's Green Jeremiad often bears religious and existential meaning. The upshot of much Green Jeremiad writing is to show how climate change and other environmental woes not only threaten the physical health and survival of our species and many others, but have also plunged humanity into an unprecedented state of spiritual crisis. Provocative. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I do think it's important that we recognize that the climate emergency, as it's now come to be called, isn't merely the sort of problem that calls for a technical fix. The technical fix will not be sufficient. The problem is all-encompassing, spiritual. It has to do with who we are and where is our place on this planet. What has come to be called the Anthropocene era, the notion that humanity's presence is so dominating and so overwhelming that in effect, as Bill McKibben put it back in 1989, which is a key text for all this, the spiritual crisis of the Anthropocene is, as he put it, there's nobody here but us. If there's nobody here but us, how do we find meaning? How do we find a place? Nothing that we see around us amounts to anything more but a reflection of our own technology, our own construction, that leaves us in a state of profound existential loneliness. And McKibben refers to, who is a person of faith, refers particularly to the biblical book of Job, surprisingly. Who would have thought that the classic work of Jeremiah about climate change, the definitive book, The End of Nature, would take as its text, as the preacher would say, the book of Job, and the sense of realizing that we are not necessarily the center and end-all and be-all of being on this planet. So I think it's important that he not only analyze this from the late 1980s already as a spiritual crisis, but he recognized that some sort of a spiritual compass would be needed to find our way beyond it. And in that regard, figures like Pope Francis, one may say, Patriarch Bartholomew, have been key figures in articulating not only the nature of the crisis, not only in effect prophesying about the peril that this represents, which is not only a peril to our agriculture, to our transportation, to our whole way of living, but really for our sense of meaning and place in the universe.
Okay, great. I love that idea about the book of Job being an environmental text. That really is great. And I think about, you know, when God appears to Job in this, you know, great theophany at the end and goes on about the crocodile.
Yes.
An example of that. Yeah, okay. One more passage from the book. Maybe you can comment on this. And it's on a similar kind of theme. If we, this is you again writing, and this is not page 8, if we, within the full sweep of human history, become the culture that ends up destroying the sustaining grounds of life on the most splendidly vital and variegated astronomical body yet discoverable, we will have to answer for more than the adversities falling directly to us. We become answerable for the life and health of all those, both human and non-human, who count as most vulnerable in our own age, as well as for all who would come after us. And if there exists a loving yet formidable one, that's capital O, one, who serves as a sustaining ground of all being, it is sobering to suspect we must ultimately be found answerable to that one.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a sobering line, but it's a powerful line. I mean, can you any comment on that?
It does call to mind a conversation I had with a visitor here to our Sewanee campus, who at the time was served, if I have the office correctly, as vice president of the Sierra Club. We talked about some of the spiritual dimensions of the climate and other environmental crises. And part of his sense, he was not sympathetic to the Christian outlook that I held, and suggested that, well, there's a spiritual vein in all of this, but saw the Christian faith as an impediment to a resolution. And it seemed to me that to me, I think that the sense that there really is some kind of personal God to whom we're answerable. That to me, that's significant, that we have to answer to someone. And in saying that, I don't mean necessarily that we're talking about fire and brimstone raining down, but whenever we feel responsible to someone rather to simply an idea, it ups the ante, I think, for our moral sense of things. And I do think that to recognize that the climate crisis is not the only environmental crisis that I wanted to talk about, but to recognize it's not only a major, to paraphrase Al Gore, inconvenience and distress to us, but it really is something that, to the extent to which we are certainly the primary agents of this circumstance, we have to answer somehow to the creatures of Earth, to those who come after us, and I think to a God who called creation good in the beginning. And that sense that we are answerable brings dignity to our position, but it also is rather sobering.
Yeah, for sure.
And, and for us as well.
Yeah, good. Okay. Let me pick up the thread there. You're the guest to the campus years ago from the Sierra Club, who believed the religion gets in the way, you know, of good environmental politics and policies. You know, I've had on this podcast before religiously minded environmental thinkers like Deborah Reinstra, Norman Wirzba, and I've put this kind of question to them, but I'm interested in hearing from you too. A lot of people are concerned about the environment, and they're frustrated with the way that religions generally, I guess, seem to get in the way of progress in combating climate change, climate emergency. And religious people in America are seen to harbor beliefs that are contrary to science or that resist realities portrayed by science. My question for you, since you are a religious person, but also very much a person of political, of environmental conscience, do you experience the same frustrations with religion that you hear expressed by this man at the, you know, who was a visitor to your campus? And contrary to those frustrations, is there in your mind a distinct contribution that religion as such and per se can make in the battle against climate change?
Well, thank you, Matt. I think, like most every other thinking person in America right now, one has to feel frustration about any number of obstacles to some of the changes and initiatives that we believe are necessary. But having said that, I think my take would be a little bit different on this, because I think it sometimes is not sufficiently recognized that while, yes, the churches have their own failings to answer for, and as do Christians and persons of other faiths. But I'm not sure it has been fully recognized that some of the chief voices that have heightened awareness of what we're facing are in fact those who've been committed Christians. And just to name some names, Al Gore, who studied religion at Yale, Bill McKibben, probably the main voice still for decades, speaks from a Christian perspective. Wendell Berry, whose testimony is many faceted, again, over many decades. And then to go back just a bit in time, Denise Levertov, who was an important prophet about war as well as the environment. Francis Collins, a scientist who speaks from a Christian perspective. So when you look at all of that span, it's sort of the notion that Christian leaders are not involved, and we mentioned Pope Francis and Patriarch Bartholomew. You put all that together, I think you have a significant, it's certainly only one aspect of the Christian presence in all of this, but it's an important one. And even figures like the late E.O. Wilson, a very prominent biologist and scientist who was not a Christian believer, he nonetheless recognized that because churches touch upon such a large sector of the American populace, it was important to draw support from that quarter. And that support, of course, has not been by any means uniform, but he recognized that at least potentially faith communities of all sorts have an immense potential in America and otherwise.
Okay, that's very hopeful for a religious person like me. So let me ask you another question, seeking maybe hope or not, about another part of my life, which is literature, okay? A point you make in the book, you come back to it a couple times, is the question, really, of whether literature has a role to play in combating climate change or climate emergency. If I were to take the skeptical position and assert, okay, that there really isn't much that literature can do to effectuate change in the minds of people, why might I be right in that assertion, and why might I be wrong?
Yes, well, I think many of us recall that phrase of Shelley, who said that, you know, that poets, writers are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, and there's good cause to be skeptical about that. but as I suggest, that maybe if they're not unacknowledged legislators, they can be prophets or lobbyists within the legislative sphere. So it's true that people like Milda Kibben start to feel very discouraged after book, and much of which he has argued to occur has not occurred. But yet, where would we be, even the recent legislation that does give promise in the United States that climate change, that certain initiatives will be taken? A lot of that goes back to that book of 1989, Bill McKibben's. A lot of the whole environmental movement is a result, if we think of literature rather broadly, as an imaginative investment. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was the definitive book that I think brought about that change. Sometimes the influence is rather indirect. But again, as I noted, that someone like Al Gore, not noted mainly as a writer, of course, but certainly as a spokesperson for these things, you know, when he has this conspicuous devotion to Rachel Carson's writing before him, that certainly indicates that if writers don't necessarily bring about an immediate change in the entire populace, they're speaking to people who in large part can be change agents nonetheless. And in particular, the greatest contribution of literature isn't necessarily in the direct argument of these figures, but to the expansion of imagination. Because imagination, in Coleridge's famous view, isn't simply, you know, what thinking of fantasy land and things that might be. Imagination is that power of vision that enables us to see the wholeness of reality. Imagination is both what is required to produce lasting literature, but it's also what literature can help us develop and expand. Not always very immediately, not always in the way we might wish, but to the extent that literature can open the mind and heart, as few other forms of art necessarily can, I think it carries at least that potential.
Fantastic. I that's a very compelling case. You convinced me, John. Okay, I'm no longer a skeptic. Okay. A couple more questions to ask you today. First is, you know, in the book again, it's such a beautifully readable book, and it's an elegantly written book, and it mentions a lot of figures there. Do you have in the book a favorite Green Jeremiah writer or journalist or filmmaker or cultural figure?
Well, if I can mention two, one for nonfiction and one for fiction.
All right.
Nonfiction, and I'm thinking, although I love lots of dead writers,
yeah.
but I'll mention two living ones, Bill McKibben already, because
yeah.
I think he has approached these questions from so many different angles, and he's drawn upon the cloud of witnesses of other writers before him. That's one of the things I love about his early book, The End of Nature. The naturalist William Bartram, Henry Thoreau, Wendell Berry, Barry Lopez, all these writers, he draws on the best of what they have contributed. But in the realm of fiction, I think an enormously helpful and imaginatively rich novel is Barbara Kingsolver's Flight Behavior, which you know, addresses that very difficult question. How do you write about something like climate change in the realm of fiction without simply browbeating people, without being too painfully obvious about where the narrative might be headed and so forth? And she succeeds in doing that in a masterful way. And particularly what strikes me, because I live in rural Tennessee, and that's where her book is set, as a matter of fact, in rural Tennessee. We all have a tendency maybe to look down on some of our fellow Americans. Rural Tennesseans are not known these days for being environmental activists. How does one understand some of the mindset of people who have a very different take from us in some of these respects? And she does that, I think, brilliantly in the novel. Her protagonist, Della Robbia, is herself a rural Tennessean. Who is treated sympathetically, as are most of the other characters, including the Christian pastor in that book. So I think that she is one of the few who have really addressed that challenge. And as you know, Amitav Ghosh suggests, well, there hasn't been enough real climate change fiction and so forth. But I'm grateful for one or two really great books.
Great suggestion. Thank you. That's a great suggestion. I've read some of her books, not that one. I'll go back and read that one, actually, based on that. So let me leave you with this question here, kind of an idea that you invoke. You know, you hold to the idea in the book that we need to maintain hope in the face of our climate challenges, but you elaborate on a specific kind of hope that you call Christian hope, and you point out that Christian hope is not naive, right? It's not a virtue. It's more a virtue, that is, than it is just a wish. You write this, I'm quoting you here, understood as an outgrowth of love and faith, Christian hope would signify a radical trust in and abandonment to a divine presence beyond ourselves, trust in the eschatological mystery of redemption. So I guess my question is this, how do you practice such hope in a future obstructed by so many crises, you know, environmental crises, nuclear crises, and other crises? And for you, does anything get in the way of that hope?
I think a great deal, Matt, gets in the way of the hope, for sure. And that's part of what I take hope to mean, potentially, that in no way does it ignore or diminish the forces of sin, we certainly may say, the forces of diminishment that are powerful in the world, and which we're certainly Jesus was fully aware of as well. I like to recall the statement in the letter of 1 Peter, to give a reason for the hope that is in you, and to look for reasons of hope, and the Christian story in it, and where it is headed, if not all the stops along the way, is a reason for hope. And ultimately, one does has to ask, is the whole teleology, the whole direction of life toward an abyss, toward a nothingness, or toward love. And I think one's own experience, at least what I try to remind myself, is I do believe it's toward love, it's toward being rather than toward nothingness. That's the ultimate question. And to get back to the Jeremiad, I think part of the Jeremiad may be counterintuitive, maybe ironic. It seems to be grief, anger, a lot of what it motivates it, but it could not be articulated in the first place if there was not a spot of caring and love that generated it. And that's true of all forms of the Jeremiad, green or otherwise. It's sort of what we do with our grief and our mourning. So again, you know, one other example of not a green Jeremiah, but that always moves me because I've been interested in Harriet Beecher Stowe for some years. Stowe suffered a devastating loss when she lived in Cincinnati when her infant son died of cholera. She was absolutely debilitated by that for a while until she saw a way to direct her grief to identify with slave mothers who had suffered losses of their children. And that's sort of, in addition to the fugitive slave law of 1850, what led to the writing of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which in turn had an enormous influence. So she transformed her grief into hope. That's something that we all at least strive to do, I think, along the way.
Fantastic. Thank you, John. I do feel hope, as you describe it. Christian hope, yeah, hope in Christ, which is not a hope which looks past very real challenges coming our way that may be very rigorous. But ultimately, yeah, that this tends toward something, toward love rather than toward nothingness and the abyss. I believe that very much. Thank you so much, John, for your beautiful work and for your, you know, intelligence and just brightness of spirit. It's great to talk to you today.
My pleasure as well, Matt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.